China de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denis Jilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
Bye. got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how.
So coming up next on your free radio on the net is the July 7th edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides 2022. Of course, you'll likely be also listening to it on the Huff Archives, where sometimes we have problems netcasting. Well, sometimes we have problems with the archives, too. But I guess you can choose between those two choices. So we're going to be piecing together numerous interviews and probably picking up some stuff. Well, I'm not entirely sure what we're going to be doing, so perhaps we'll both be surprised. But listen in, and you'll hear more.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So why not kick off the show with an article from the Mercury News from July 6th, Wednesday. Homeless housing site ready after 11-year wait. From Oakland, after several delays, Homefulness Project set to welcome tenants. That's by Marissa Kendall. After more than a decade of work, hundreds of thousands of dollars raised, and multiple city permitting hurdles jumped, a housing development built by homeless people for homeless people is ready to accept new residents. The four new townhouses on MacArthur Boulevard in East Oakland will house about eight families rent-free after the city recently waived the project's final hurdle, a $40,000 impact fee. The developer, a grassroots nonprofit group called Poor Magazine, says the project has been ready for occupancy for more than a year, but kept getting caught in city fees and other bureaucracy. On Tuesday, members of Poor Magazine and other supporters of the project, dubbed Homefulness, gathered in Frank Iguala Plaza outside Oakland's Planning and Building Department. They cheered the city's approval while also condemning what they said is a convoluted and expensive permitting and construction process that delayed much-needed housing in the midst of a homelessness crisis. Poor Magazine, which hopes Homefulness will serve as an example to other grassroots housing efforts led by homeless people and people in poverty, urged the city to pass new rules to expedite homeless housing projects. Today we're praying and celebrating. We're also demanding that they don't pull this on other people, said Poor Magazine co-founder Lisa Gray Garcia. The city did not respond to a request for comment. The saga started in 2011 when Gray Garcia and her team scraped together $89,000 to buy a rundown duplex. The nonprofit, which runs a magazine, radio station, school, and aid organization, mostly relies on donations from affluent members of its Solidarity family to fund its projects. They fixed up the building, and Gray Garcia and her son, who had been homeless, moved in along with several other residents. Then they started work on four new townhomes on the property. The team instantly ran into hurdle after hurdle as they struggled to navigate the city's planning and building rules with no experience and little money or other resources, Gray Garcia said. Last year, the four new townhomes were finished, but the city wouldn't let anyone move in until Poor Magazine built a 3 parking spaces on the property. Gray Garcia said it was a waste, as few residents would have cars. But the group raised the money and built the spaces. It cost $34,000 to level the ground, pour the concrete, and move a utility box, she said. After the work was already done, the city granted their request to waive the parking requirement, said Janelle Orsi, co-founder of Sustainable Economies Law Center, which has been helping Poor Magazine. It's been this harrowing experience, she said. The latest hurdle was a $40,000 impact fee, ironically the bulk of which would go toward helping the city build affordable housing. Poor Magazine held a protest in March, even barging into the lobby of the city's building and planning department, filled out the 40-page fee waiver application, and reached out to local officials for help. Vice Mayor Rebecca Capian and Council Member Carol Fife gave their support, Gray Garcia said. Capian is a huge proponent of getting people off the streets and getting them housed, said Kimberly Jones. Kaplan's chief of staff. And so this project resonated with her for that reason. When asked about the hurdles Poor Magazine faced in building the project, Jones said, "We see their point, and it is among the things we would like to work with them on in the future." Kaplan's office is working on a citywide resolution that would end parking requirements for small housing developments, Jones said. Gray Garcia also wants to see high permitting fees lowered or waived for homeless housing projects built by people who are homeless or living in poverty themselves. Her team also suggested the city hire a liaison to help grassroots developers like Poor Magazine through the process. Those reforms could help Poor Magazine with its second housing project, 14 accessory dwelling units on another lot the nonprofit recently purchased on MacArthur. They hope to submit plans to the city within the next few months. There are more than 5,000 people living without housing in Oakland, and the original Homefulness project has a wait list of about 18 people. In the time it has taken to build the project, 3 people on the wait list have died, succumbing to chronic illnesses, depression, and substance abuse that was incarcerated by their homelessness, Gray Garcia said. She hopes to start moving people in this August. The group is working on outfitting the units with kitchen appliances while also helping prospective residents get ready for life indoors. For some, that means attending support groups to help them break the habit of hoarding, a behavior for unhoused people that they often pick up to help them deal with the chaos of life on the streets, Gray Garcia said. Now the hard work begins of actually getting our folks all the things they need so they can actually live inside, she said. It's not just a roof. It's a healing space. There's a lot we have to do just to help our folks be housed. And that's why spending all this time fighting the city is such a waste of time and a waste of resources. And that again is a story, homeless housing site ready after 11-year wait. After several delays, Homefulness Project set to welcome tenants. That's by Marissa Kendall. July 6th, Mercury News, if I haven't already said that before. So, it's interesting to note, this whole project began when people occupied the derelict building and just started doing the work. They were blocked, of course, repeatedly by bureaucrats, which seems to be the perennial fate of poor people trying to lift themselves up. Whether it's food not bombs trying to serve people food, whether it's individuals trying to straighten out ordinances that criminalize necessary acts of survival like sleeping, whether it's creating housing cheaply, the barriers are significant by the sort of the NIMBY wealthier class. It's pretty nasty stuff. It's depressing even in the newspapers of people who are supporters or claim to be of homeless folks. Here's the latest issue of Street Spirit, which, if you're interested, you can be able to pick up if you show up at the Huff meeting, which happens every Thursday. I guess if you're listening to this on Thursday night, it's already happened, but you can also hopefully pick up a copy of the latest July Street Spirit or Street Sheet, the San Francisco-based Coalition on Homelessness paper, also published. Actually, I think it's published twice a month, whereas Street Spirit is only published once a month, at the UN headquarters on Pacific Avenue, 703 Pacific, across from the Metro. And it's between 10 and 12, I'm told, Steve Plaich holds court. He's the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project guy who we occasionally have interviewed and spoken to, but sometimes can be hard to reach by phone. At least I find it hard to reach him by phone. He's acknowledged rather candidly he doesn't answer my calls a lot. But maybe you can get a hold of him. He claims that he is open to generally. His number is 466-6078 if you want to find a time to pick up Street Spirit if you're not able to show up at the Huff meetings, which happen 11 to 1, a little bit later sometimes, at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific. I beg your pardon. I think I told you UN headquarters is actually at 903 Pacific. I may have screwed that up. Not sure. But that's where you can get Street Spirit at 903, 10 to 12 any weekday. And sometimes you can actually find the UN headquarters open through later hours in the day. And they may have Street Spirits there. So you can pick them up. This is Street Spirit, of course, for those who don't know, is a monthly paper that can be sold. Usually it's sold for $2 or more, or donation for folks who are poor or on the streets. Anyway, Street Spirit has an article I wanted to read, sort of sad article, and a little bit late in hitting the mark, considering the damage has been done. It's about People's Park. I was actually up in Berkeley picking up Street Spirit a couple days ago and didn't get to People's Park, which I usually, well, occasionally slip through, do some interviews at, see what's going on, even use the restroom. Apparently the restroom there, which was established by, I don't know if it was established by the community or insistently supported by the community. It's a brick structure, concrete structure that's been at least in place since it's been a long time. 1990s, I believe, back in 1991, 92. People's Park, of course, has been around since the 60s, the late 60s, when it was established by the community. They tore down the fences that the University of California had set up to essentially surround a vacant, swampy piece of land that they had been used for low-income housing that the university had torn down but hadn't done anything on. The people took it over, and the National Guard moved in to evict them, and there was killings, but people, the community continued to occupy the area, and People's Park has been struggling for 50 odd years until now, and this is the most recent situation. Here's a story by Alistair Boone, who's the editor of the new editor. Well, she's actually been around for a number of years now, but when I used to write for the paper, the editor was a guy called Terry Messman, whose stuff I like better. But Alistair is writing a story that's got some interesting information. Let's check it out. An eerie quiet, she writes, has fallen over People's Park as UC Berkeley takes its initial steps toward building the housing development that could soon stand in its place. The encampment that has housed some 60 people since the beginning of the pandemic has disappeared. Large piles of mulch and giant lots are poised along Dwight Way, and the park, typically bustling with visitors and volunteers, has fallen silent. In May, City of Berkeley employees began moving residents of People's Park Encampment into transitional housing at the Roadway Inn on University Avenue. I just love this kind of transitional housing. What it means is it's a dumping area where they're going to put people for as the pretext for going in to destroy the People's Park homeless encampment and build a fancy upscale student housing, expensive upscale student housing. And then after that's all been done, they'll dump these folks from the Roadway Inn. Sort of similar to the way the United, various agencies, the city, the county, and Santa Cruz County have housed people during COVID with state money and now have dumped them out unceremoniously onto the streets, as various people reported in the last show, if you've heard, been following this Bathrop Spears Broadside series. As of this writing, Alistair Boone continues, all 42 of the rooms at the Roadway are occupied by former residents of the park, according to the assistant of the city manager, Peter Radu. The rest of the residents are living at the city's New Horizons shelter, a congregate shelter on Grayson Street, have been placed in other local housing, have left the park, and remain unhoused or are unaccounted for. I'm sorry that Alistair didn't get any more specific figures. As you see officials move steadily forward with plans to break ground on People's Park, activists and community groups are working to keep up a resistance. The park is closer than it has been in decades to development as the university plans to begin construction this summer, by which they mean being essentially paved over with housing and university buildings that facilitate fundraising for the university and increased enrollment for the university. In the wake of these developments, park supporters are doing what they have done for decades, preparing for a summer of protest. I'd like to point out this article, which appears in July. We're already into the summer, halfway through the summer, and unfortunately there's so far no articles I've seen on protest. Of course, I wouldn't expect it from the mainstream media, but I haven't seen much in Street Spirit either, but perhaps I've missed something. Who knows? We've been battling this development for two or three decades, says Boomer, a former park resident. People's Park is the ground where we get to lay it down on the table. If we don't get to have rights here, we don't get rights at all. In recent weeks, the university has also shut off water at the park, welded the bathroom doors shut, and removed trash cans. Cal spokesperson Dan Mogiloff said that the park is scheduled to be closed for construction sometime this summer, but did not provide a specific date. The university's goal is to complete construction of the 1,100-bed student housing complex by the summer of 2024, so that students can move in at the beginning of the 2024-2025 academic year. The People's Park development plans also include a supportive housing complex for 119 currently and formerly houseless people. UC Berkeley will donate the land for this project to Resources for Community Development, a local nonprofit that builds affordable housing. Sounds like kind of a press release from the university. Alistair should know better, but I read on. When Street Spirit visited the park at the end of June, members of a local church walked around the park with bags of socks and toothpaste, struggling to find people to give them to. An unmarked police car circled the park twice and then drove away. Just one encampment resident, Eddie, remained. Eddie, who is permitted to remain at the park as the city works on securing a housing placement, says the park is the only remaining place where he can exist freely. This is a place where everyone who comes is equal, no matter what race, age, or creed you come from. If they take away the park, they're going to take away the only place that identifies us as individual people, the only place where everyone is free and equal. Eddie says he is eager to be housed as long as he can stay in Berkeley, but he's not want to see the park close. He feels confused about the process of finding a transitional housing placement, I love these terms, and says the park should remain open as a refuge for the public as the number of public spaces that are accessible to unhoused people fade away. Activists have been fighting to protect the park since first occupying the land in 1969, as I mentioned, successfully guarding against UC police and the National Guard, who wanted to return the land to the university so it could build there. The fight to protect the park reignited in 2017 when Chancellor Crist announced that the university would build student housing there. In June, the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group succeeded in having the park listed in the National Register of Historic Places, a designation the group hoped would force Cal to build elsewhere. But the university was undeterred, arguing that their environmental impact report already evaluated the historic status of the site, and I might add, ignored it. Activists, or seem to have, I haven't read their environmental impact report, but if they're proceeding to demolish the park and build a, what is it, 11-story or larger building, that's it for People's Park. Activists have also, the story continues, taken to the courts to try to halt development plans. On July 29th, an Alameda County Superior Court judge will hear a lawsuit by the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group and community group Make UC a Good Neighbor. The lawsuit argues that the Environmental Impact Report, the EIR, accompanying Cal's long-range development plan, the plan that outlines the People's Park project, among others, was inadequate. Winning the lawsuit would mean that Cal would have to rewrite the EIR, a lengthy process that could delay construction for months and incur hefty fees. The city at Berkeley, as once among groups that balked at the Cal's long-range development plan, the LRDP, and the accompanying EIR, but after Cal announced it planned to increase enrollment by 33.7%, the city sued the university in 2019, saying it had not adequately analyzed the impact this enrollment jump would have on city services. Ultimately, the two agreed to settle outside of court, and last summer, UC Berkeley announced that it would start paying the city of Berkeley $4.1 million per year. This is the bribe the university is giving the city, and I think it's been talked about and denounced by some activists like Carol Denny on this show, for its use of city services, more than doubling the $1.8 million annual fee that it had previously paid to the city. The city dropped the lawsuit and also agreed not to sue over the LRDP and the EIR, even though the head of Berkeley's planning department had previously issued a scathing 75-page response to the plan, saying they were so inadequate that they should be fully revised. The city has now joined the university as a partner in the People's Park project. That is to say, the demolition of the People's Park. It's amusing that they call it People's Park. What they really mean is the end of People's Park. In order to ensure that everyone who has lived in the park wouldn't be displaced onto city streets or other city parks when construction starts, we wanted to ensure that everyone had a meaningful, safe indoor option that would provide them a pathway to permanent housing to end their unsheltered status, Berkeley City Mangler or Manager Radu said. And of course, this is the standard chitter-chatter, double-speak terminology that cities like Santa Cruz and Berkeley use. Pathway to permanent housing, a meaningful, safe indoor option to ensure everyone who has lived there won't be displaced when construction starts, i.e. won't be there with the neighborhood to protest that whole thing, or in court demanding that the city respect the Martin versus Boise decision, which says, find us real shelter before you destroy the shelter that we have. But, of course, the problem with this temporary shelter is that it is temporary, and it destroys the shelter that they already existed without any real guarantees of any kind of permanent shelter, and it's also very expensive. It's clearly an attempt to simply proceed with the project while keeping a weather eye on the courts. Such is my belief, anyway. The city is taking the lead on outreach to People's Park residents, placement in transitional housing, opening Sacred Rest, a new daytime drop-in center at First Presbyterian Church, and replacing the park's restrooms. Berkeley is paying for the majority of the 18-month lease with the roadway using a $4.7 million grant from the state's Encampment Resolution Fund to pay the lease for 12 months and contract with Adobe Services, the agency providing supportive services. Cal will contribute $2.2 million for the remaining 6 months of the contract. I think I was reading elsewhere that Adobe recently has stopped its contract with the city, but I could be wrong about that in Berkeley. This is one of these groups that is sort of essentially the hired police and pseudo-nannies that are supposed to keep the homeless people in line and herd them in the right direction. Quote, "This is how stuff gets done. People with shared values come together to make things happen," Mogilev says. That's I'm not sure who Mogilev is here. Let me double check. Of course, Dan Mogilev is the Cal University of California spokesperson. So, reports from former park residents who are living at the Roadway Inn are mixed. While some say they are grateful to have a roof over their head, others have shared that the midnight curfew, the no-visitor policy, and having no keys to their own rooms have made life there very uncomfortable. Of course, all these privacy realities were in place in People's Park and are currently in place, however wretchedly in terms of other resources in, let's say, the Santa Cruz benchlands, but are not in place up at the Armory and the so-called Lookout encampment that is being used to supposedly lure people away from the benchlands in order to depopulate the benchlands by the end of the summer. Continuing the story about Berkeley, which really is kind of quite educational in terms of a lot of these anti-homeless initiatives, I think, are shared from city to city. It seems that way. Others have said that the food is inedible, that they have been locked out after curfew and not allowed back in, that they are frequently disrespected by Adobe Services staff. Don't get me wrong, of course. I'm grateful that I have a personal bathroom. I feel grateful because I got a roof over my head, I got somewhere to sleep, and I sleep good, former park resident Eric Morales told Berkeley Side. That's a conservative community publication. But when the program says they're going to support us, they're not doing that. We have housing, but that's all. Ultimately, whether they remain in transitional housing, find placement in permanent housing, or end up unsheltered elsewhere, the tight-knit community that People's Park has provided for decades will be hard to replace. You don't say. Park advocates are planning a protest on June 6th. And, of course, it would be interesting why they aren't covering this protest, or at least I haven't seen so far, as well as a series of community-oriented events to voice their support for this community. I still come to the park to see my family, former park resident Boomer told Street Spirit. Just because I move indoors doesn't mean I'm going to forsake my family. Why does there have to be this negative or inferior cloud over us, like we're less than, like our existence doesn't matter? And that's a story by Alistair Boone in the July issue of Street Spirit. This is a publication which, unfortunately, gets funding from the city of Berkeley. So while there are some criticisms of the university here and some suggested criticisms of city employees, it's not very sharp. And certainly nowhere packs the punch that street spirit stories used to do. Alistair's a nice person. Recently corresponded with her to help her try to fill in some spaces with her back issues of street spirit. But not happy with street spirit reporting, street spirit financial involvement, and well, let's start with those two. Let's take a little musical break.
I spent my whole life making somebody rich. I busted my ass for that son of a bitch, and he left me to die like a dog in a ditch. He told me I'm all used up. He used up my labor, he used up my time. He plundered my body and squandered my mind, and gave me a pension of handouts and wine. Told me I'm all used up. My kids are in hock to a god you call work, slaving their lives out for some other jerk. Yeah, my youngest in Frisco just made shipping clerk. He don't know I'm all used up. The young people reaching for power and gold don't have respect for anything old. For pennies they're bought and for promises sold, someday they'll all be used up. They use up the oil, they use up the trees, they use up the air and they use up the sea. Well, how about you, friend, and how about me? What's left when we're all used up? I'll finish my life in this crummy hotel. It's lousy with bugs, and my God, what a smell. But my plumbing still works, and I'm clear as a bell. Don't tell me I'm all used up. Outside my window, the world passes by, gives me a handout and spits in my eye. And no one can tell me, because no one knows why. I'm living, but I'm all used up. Sometimes in my dreams, I sit by a tree. My life is a book of how things used to be. Kids gather around and they listen to me. They don't think I'm all used up. And there's songs and there's laughter and things I can do. And all that I've learned I can give back to you. I'd give my last breath just to make it come true. No, I'm not all used up. They use up the oil and they use up the trees. They use up the air and they use up the sea. Well, how about you, friend, and how about me? What's left when we're all used up?
And that was Utah Phillip singing All Used Up. And I think Utah was a, he called himself more of an anarchist than a communist, but this is from a website, Hours of Communist Music. So, well, I like the song, whatever label you want to put on it. So next up is a brief interview with Olivia, who's working at the Coalition on Homelessness office in San Francisco in the heart of the Tenderloin. Coalition on Homelessness is an activist group, publishes the Street Sheet, which is a publication you can also get copies of if you look at the, well, if you get to the Huff meeting or if you get to check out the UN HQ in the morning between 10 and 12, and sometimes at other times during the day where we leave some papers there. It's a paper that's put out twice monthly, and I think it's, if not entirely homeless run, it's got a lot of homeless content. I would say probably more so these days than Street Spirit, the Oakland publication or the Berkeley publication. I think it's, not sure if they're in Oakland or Berkeley. They're somewhere, I think, right between the two. Anyway, here's a little something from Olivia. I ran into her when I picked up some street sheets.
Hi. Today is the 10th of June, 2022. I'm here at the Coalition on Homelessness, San Francisco's office, and talking with...
My name's Olivia Glowacki.
And Olivia, you were greeting some folks who are picking up some street sheets for the first time. And how long have you been doing this? You're kind of you are new at this somewhat?
I've been at the org for 4 years now.
Not that new.
Not that new, but some people have been here for 25, 30 years, so.
And then some have left. Some have come and gone. Mm-hmm. I don't see Chance Martin around here anymore.
No, and we just actually, we've had some loss, some turnover, but we always have some, new blood, and the people here are pretty great.
How has the coalition changed in the last 5 years, if it has?
Well, I'd say that the coalition in its start has been, pretty reactive, reacting to the bad policies of the city, trying to change things after they come out. But now we've been more proactive. So in 2018, we passed Prop C that was called Our City, Our Home, which is a tax on the wealthiest businesses in San Francisco. And all that money then goes for housing for homeless people.
Except for the money that comes in to defeat Budin, and out he goes.
Right. We just saw that happen.
So, had there been many initiatives before that? I know this may have been before your time, and I have had sort of sporadic involvement with the coalition over the last couple of decades. Before that, I occasionally wrote for them and distributed Street Sheet in, mostly Street Spirit though, but Street Sheet in Santa Cruz. And originally I was asking you about vehicular folks because you were orienting some folks on the realities of San Francisco now supposedly, and I would like to know whether this is generally true, at least doing a one-time expunging of records of people whose homes are being towed.
Yeah, so we've been working with the Financial Justice Project and GLIDE and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights to try and pressure SFMTA to...
Which is?
That is the San Francisco Municipal Transit or Transportation Agency.
So they run vehicle coppers?
Yeah, exactly. They do the muni, and then they also do the meter maids that end up towing folks. And so in 2020, when the pandemic started, the city actually put out that they wouldn't, tow vehicles if it was for, non-emergency or non-threatening things. So if it didn't have to be moved for something, like it was just there parked in a legal space for 72 hours, which is a reason to get towed, they wouldn't do it for poor people and people who live in their homes. And so now we're kind of seeing them go back on that, where the towing has started again, but the Financial Justice Project worked with SFMTA to basically get, one-time fee waivers, one-time, getting your car out of the tow and the storage for free, and then also getting free muni for people who are, extremely low-income or homeless.
Have you given advice, or has the coalition given advice to folks in other cities who are trying to get their governments to do something similar?
Coalition on Homelessness is pretty hyper-local to San Francisco, but there are definitely gains made for other cities across California in terms of taking out poverty tows.
How about the business of an injunction to stop the sweeps, given the fact that there's inadequate housing?
That's been a campaign for years, for decades, of the Coalition on Homelessness. And as you know, it's a tough thing to change.
Any closer to coming into being?
I would say that we were pretty close again when the pandemic first happened, because the CDC put out guidelines.
Shelter in place.
Yeah, the CDC put out guidelines that said that cops and, other folks should not be moving people out of homeless encampments, because that would only, one, obviously we know it exacerbates homelessness, but two, it would also spread coronavirus more.
Now, has the increase in a contagious but less lethal form of COVID had any impact on what seems to be the erosion of this shelter-in-place protection?
Well, one of the kind of lasting things that has happened since COVID that has been a real detriment to people on the streets right now is that before COVID, we had a wait list on 311. Anyone could call 311 and get on the shelter wait list. Now, since COVID happened, 311 has been shut down, and the only way to get shelter is through the hot team and actually calling the hot team and leaving a voicemail and basically hoping that they get in touch with you.
If you have a place to get in touch with you.
Exactly. So as you know, it's extremely difficult for folks who might not have access to, you know, charging their phone, might not be around in the same place because they're constantly getting swept and moved around.
Has police department policy shifted appreciably, let's say, between 2019 and 2022, if we go beyond the COVID protections?
No, we've seen police kind of, you know, do the same thing over and over, just, you know, working in tandem with the Department of Public Works to trash and steal homeless people's belongings.
How influential is the board of, in Santa Cruz we call them the board of stupid vipers, but supervisors, I suppose, and on both the city government and the county government here in San Francisco, how are they as far as a deterrent force against this kind of police misbehavior?
Well, it's tough because, you know, in San Francisco we have a strong mayor, so anything to veto the mayor is going to take eight supervisors to go against her. And now that we've had redistricting in San Francisco, we've kind of lost some of our progressive candidates, especially with, Matt Haney moving he won the assembly, which meant that London Breed got to pick his replacement, which is happening with Chesa, and which, you know, happened with the school board with all these recalls.
Do you have any hope for us down in Santa Cruz? any words of warning for that matter? You're shaking your head.
Well, I am a member of, like, you know, the millennial kind of Gen Z generation, and I don't think a lot of us have much hope, but I definitely don't want to spread that messaging. You know, there's always improvements to be made, and I think that, when we're coming together in coalitions, when we're banding together, that we can make those changes.
It's nice rhetoric, of course, and hopefully it's true. How are encampments and group encampments doing in San Francisco? Are there any such?
Yeah, there definitely are. I mean, it's just they're more susceptible to getting displaced and split up than in other places, like in the East Bay.
Why is that?
You know,
can we call the Oakland mayor much better than the San Francisco mayor, or the Oakland police, who are notorious, much better than the San Francisco police, who may be equally notorious?
You know, Libby Schaaf, or Mayor Breed, they're kind of two sides of the same coin. They're both implementing, you know, stuff against poor people, measures that harm poor people and take away power from us.
Any events coming up in the next month that it might be of interest for people more broadly in California to know about, that the coalition has some awareness of?
Well, we always are doing our human rights work group. That happens on Wednesdays, and so we will be having a group meeting at the Castro Library this upcoming Wednesday. From
the address of that? Who knows? The Castro Library.
Castro Library
must be in the book or on the net.
Yeah.
There isn't any book anymore.
Yeah, so we'll be meeting there, getting in person with folks. I can put you in touch with the organizer so that you can get that info.
And you're inviting, of course, the two folks who were, for their first time, getting street sheets here to pass on, sell, make a little coffee money, or half a cup of coffee money, that sort of thing. You mentioned that there's a call for writing, for folks who are writing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have a stipend. We got a grant that basically pays homeless writers or artists to either, you know, turn in pieces of poetry, artwork, or, you know, investigative journalism, or just, you know, pieces about what it is like for folks to be on the street, what it is like to be living in your car in this day and age, and what things you want to see change.
And where should they send their material? Who should they address it to? If they're sending it on the internet, what do they do? If they send it postally, what do they do? Or give me a website people should go to get that information.
Yeah, so you can go ahead and email it to TJ Johnston, TJJOHNSTON, @COHSF.org, or you can send it in the mail to 280 Turk Street, or come in and...
That's the address of the coalition.
Right, or you can come in and just give it to us. Yeah, you'll have to work with our editor, TJ, to see if we have room for it in this month's paper, because we do 2 issues a month, and we're always covering different stuff. But yeah, that's always an opportunity.
Great. Anything you want to add for folks who are listening to this, who are interested in the coalition and the street sheet, that might not have been covered by what I've already asked you?
Just give us a call, you know. Call us up. Tell us what's going on. Tell us, you know, what we can do, what your priorities are, and that's how we form our campaigns.
Much connection with RAP, by the way?
Absolutely, yeah. Paul Bowden is our
founder.
Yeah.
Former big cheese, you might say.
That's right, yeah.
Is there some event coming up that you're going to be, perhaps a march on Breed's office with torches and pitchforks?
Well, we don't have that planned yet, but if that's your priority, come and make it happen with us.
You have your new Arm the Homeless campaign, perhaps?
Maybe one day, yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
No, thanks for doing this.
And we've been talking with
Olivia Glowacki at the Coalition on Homelessness.
Thanks, Olivia.
Thank you.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive. The revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors swung open. Mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. 1 million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now. After the colonies, soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed. measure were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks, organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. All the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 all beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the
And that was a song with mostly intelligible lyrics from David Rovics called After the Revolution. So I haven't been posting much on Santa Cruz Indie Media recently, but I did do something a couple days ago, called Preparing to Defend the Likely Sweeps. And this was a very brief narrative. It was a paragraph or two about our tabling, our being Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom Huff. Three of us went out to do some tabling on Pacific Avenue on, I guess it was the 3rd of July, on Sunday, and giving out flyers to folks who were passing by. Very few people took them, but we did get a few interviews, and you'll be hearing some of those. One of the flyers was called Good Answers to Some Bad Questions from Friendly Cops and Helpful Social Workers. And another was Services Not Sweeps, Where's the Money, Stop Homeless Dumping. And we did a little petitioning there. Not a lot of people biting, so to speak, but the weather was nice. Some of the conversations were friendly. And there were people that I hadn't seen for quite a while sort of showing up. You can actually see these petitions and download them from the story Preparing to Defend the Likely Sweeps. It's all about, of course, the benchland sweeps that are being threatened by, or promised, if you will, by city mangler Matt Huffaker. He's the city mangler, or city manager, as he calls himself, and that's slated for the end of the summer as the city council, or the shitty council, as I call them, go on a six-week vacation, having squandered a lot of the homeless funding in order to set up an enforcement mechanism to go after homeless people that are in any way annoying police or conservative residents, or setting up tents where they shouldn't be, i.e. anywhere outside of the very small token programs. And, of course, that's impossible, since the token programs cover maybe 150 on there. Matt Effiger said he'd be expanding them to 200, maybe 250 people. But, of course, there are over 1,000 folks who are unhoused in the Santa Cruz area. I'm talking mostly about the city, not just the county. So that's ridiculous. But it's not unusual that politicians make ridiculous statements. Newspapers dutifully and sedulously report them as though they were true. And people sort of quote them as though they're official authorities, but they just aren't. And you can see that by looking around town as you walk through. So check out Preparing to Defend the Likely Sweeps if you want to see my response to these phony narratives. Or show up at a Huff meeting. We're going to be meeting every Thursday. You missed the last one if you're listening to this when it's first netcast on the evening of the 7th, but you can wander into the next one if you want, or give a call to me at Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 831-423-4833.
So, recently I was in Berkeley, as I mentioned, picking up different Street Spirits, the new issue, and I stopped by one of the few remaining encampments that I know about, although I'm sure they're all over the place, still hiding and seeking to just survive. The encampment on the border of Oakland and Berkeley called Here There. You can see it as you drive along Martin Luther King, if you're familiar with Berkeley. And I stopped and chatted with a guy using the porta-potty / wash station that was same old blue wash station that was near the encampment. And we sat down on a bench. They actually haven't taken the benches out there, which is nice. And talked. And here's some of what we said.
So it's about 7:10 on July 5th. I'm here in Berkeley, walking next to 5/10 on Adelaide Street, and it's two encampments next to each other. One of them is called Here There, originally started by the Poverty Tour some time ago, years ago. Mike Zent, Mike Lee, Dan McMullen, others, and thought I would check in on them, deliver a few newspapers, see what's cooking, if anything. So it looks like about 16 tents, including the large communal tent. Well, actually more, 17, 18. Let's see if anybody's around. It's pretty barren. Usually there are folks sort of hanging about in the eating and area, and there's an area that usually in the past and so forth. Don't see that happening. There's a guy washing his hands at the washing station at the porta potty nearby. So, I'm talking with
Julio,
and I see you have an instrument. You say you just visited Santa Cruz. You're a musician.
I like to make noise.
And
I wouldn't call it music.
Perhaps others would.
A very small amount of people.
That's the BART train passing by, folks. A regular feature of the Here There camp that I've seen in the past, or unfortunately heard in the past. So, how long have you been in the camp, or are you currently in the camp?
Currently, I think it's running 2 years, and this month would be 2 years and 1 month.
How are the authorities treating the camp?
They have no complaints, since we seldom give them any bother.
And do you have much connection, interaction with other camps around town?
Pretty much self contained. There's another camp down south, another 100 yards. They don't have as many enforcements of rules as we do, but sometimes they're affiliated with us because of their proximity.
Good connection?
They're usually okay. Sometimes you'll hear them arguing about whatever binge they're on or whatever the hell's going on down there.
What kind of rules would you say distinguish yours from theirs?
Sobriety, for one. You just got to get past their leader, I guess.
How many folks would you estimate live in that camp?
Down there? Less than five?
Say that again.
Less than five, I'm going to say. One.
And in the camp, the larger camp here?
This one, I'm going to say closer to a dozen.
Has the number changed over the last 2 years much?
Oh, yeah. It's gone up and down. I think we were down to like seven at one point. And I think the most we had here was in the mid-teens, 15 or 16 or something like that.
And is there many... are there any long-time folks? Would you say are you the longest, or are there others who've been there longer than you?
There's a couple dudes. There's one dude that's been here longer. Two dudes have been here longer than me. I don't know how much longer.
And what kind of rules would you say, other than the sobriety rule, characterize your camp?
Just a general lack of mayhem. We try to keep the area somewhat clean, but we still have detriments to that.
It's still a challenge?
Oh, sure. People walking by just dropping trash because they figure it's just a bum camp. Who cares? Or even our own members that have a tendency to just need their mother to clean up behind them.
What's happened most significantly in the camp, let's say, in the last 6 months, if you could think of anything? What's the most striking memory you have? Which may actually have nothing to do with the camp, I understand. But
it's been Groundhog's Day every day here.
All this always is a repetition of the same procedures and things?
Actually, the only thing I'd say would be the difference that sticks out most would be the lack of food donations. We've had diminished food supply over here. It used to be the point where we had no choice but to dose stupid amounts away. And now we're barely able to pick through what we do get. Sometimes it's pure trash, though, when they send Vienna sausages.
You're not a Vienna sausages fan.
Stale pretzels or moldy food of whatever sort. It just kind of defeats the purpose, because we're not going to eat that.
Before you were in this camp, where were you? Were you...
In my car.
And how did that compare with being in the camp?
I wasn't confined to the anchor of the car, I guess. I had two cats at the time and a dog, and we're all crammed in this car. But we would go to a studio. I would blow glass, and the dog would get out, the cats would get out. But after the, you know, work at the shop, at the studio, he'd be back in the car. So being in the camp gave him for a little bit more leg room.
Do you still have your pets with you, or your companions?
Yes, one cat and one dog. The other one, another older cat, passed a few months before he turned 18.
Name of the animals?
His name was Dr. Beauregard.
And two that are still with you?
Miss Nomer is the cat, and Caffrington Marshall is the dog.
Is this Pooch who's been lurking around us, your dog?
That's the one. She's over in the shade. She's got some shade over there.
That makes sense. Beautiful weather today, I must say. What are the needs of the camp, would you say, the strongest needs that you have? Or do you have, does the camp need anything particular? Because this would go out on the net. I doubt anybody's going to come rushing up and help out, but it's just as a matter of interest.
Drinking water is cool in abundance. But pretty much after that, even though we have diminished donations of food, we still make do. I mean, nobody's over here starving to death.
What's the gender balance in the camp, if any?
We'll say like 95% male right now.
And are you supportive of each other generally? And if so, how?
Depends on the person. If I catch somebody rooting through my shit, then I consider them a thief. When I've got shit gone missing in the exact same spot I caught them rooting around in. But even with the camp's desire to have him leave through consensus, he refuses to leave, which is kind of against the point of having any rules. But when we tried to enforce it, they tried to turn it into a race card, race deal, bullshit. To the extent that they called the Berkeley chapter's president of the NAACP, which I thought was pretty stupid, because anyone who's being abused, any coloreds that are being abused, are being done so by their own. There's only a few dark folks here, and two are directly related, and one of them completely verbally and fucking mentally just twist the child's head to the point where it's so annoying that other campers speak up. Like, lady, shut up.
And so there's certain conflict in the camp at the moment.
Of course. It's been pretty much dropped because of the bullying tactic that the NAACP guy said that he will force the entire camp to leave if she's made to leave. And I'm like, whatever, dude. Do your thing. Just get the thief out. Well, we're going to work on it. That was like 3 months ago now.
So you have to be a patient person or pretty oblivious to be able to... Let me put it this way. Has the amount of theft stopped or lessened at all?
Once it was discovered that there was a security camera put in place, it diminished to zero.
Really? So, but you're still of the opinion that it would be better if this particular person went their way?
Absolutely. I mean, they violate the non...
no thieving?
They violate being here with non-sobriety as well. They come in here inebriated from drinking and shit, and it's just like they think nobody knows, but it's very obvious. And the worst part of it is that bar that just opened not a couple months ago has already banned him for thievery.
And you're pointing to a bar across the street?
Right across the street. Within, what is that, 60 feet, 100 feet? Puts us in a bad light, having him fucking live over here and stealing from the fucking bar. Coming over here stealing from other members, and it's like, dude, he stole from my fucking dog. He's a piece of shit.
A lot of BART trains going by.
Yeah.
You were saying?
He stole blankets off of my dog's bed, trying to claim that he was cold, when there were plenty of blankets to be chosen that were not my dog's bed blankets. And when confronted about this, he said that he purchased them at the Goodwill at first, after denying it for 10, 20, 30 minutes. And then after that, he finally admitted that he had them because he had to get them because he was getting cold. And it's like, dude, just fucking admit the shit and stop lying. You fucking, what are you, 5 years old? And you can't fucking bear to tell the truth and accept the consequences as they go? Your mom didn't fucking beat you enough as a kid?
So, what are the best things about this camp that you can think of?
Too much food, actually. In the lack of food, there's still plenty to eat. The clothing is... What do you call that? Almost infinite.
You get a lot of clothing.
I think I've gone like a year without doing laundry because of the new clothes that come in so often.
Is there much communication or contact with, what's your sense about other homeless people in Berkeley? Is the situation getting better or worse or different than it was 2 years ago?
They've helped a few folks out. I've seen them get housed, but usually they've got whatever mental or chemical issues that no matter how well the fucking plate is put in front of them, they manage to fucking knock it off the table somehow.
Have many people who have left this camp, in your view, been successful, or do you have any sense of the outcome later on?
They've progressed. Some have progressed, I guess. Gone into housing and stuff. I don't know about their progress in what they deem as their pursuit of happiness in life, but, you know, at least they got them a house or whatever. A kitchen, you know, a bathroom and all that bullshit. Walls, roof.
And the train made me forget my questions, but you've given me a lot. This will be out on the net probably on Thursday night. I'll give you my card. You can hear it. It's archived. If you ever get to a computer in the future, you'll be able to hear what you just said today, as well as the rest of the stuff that goes out on the show I do. So.
Right on. What's your name?
I'm Robert Norris.
Julio.
Mucho gusto, Julio. Mine's posted on the fence next to the main tent. May you find compassion wherever you dig. And share your thoughts on homelessness is the bigger sign. Unshelter in place. Homeless hardest impacted. And beyond the fence is a BART, property of San Francisco Bay Area Rapid Transit District. Police, Bay Area Rapid Transit Police, no trespassing. No lodging, no dumping, no parking. BART Police, 877-679-7000. Violators are subject to citation and or arrest. Penal code 602M, 647E, 373.3. California Vehicle Code 22523. So beyond the fence, some large, I'd say 10-foot high letters here, there, in sort of facing displays.
So if you're ever up in Berkeley, if you're ever up there, check out Adeline Street, where it intersects with Martin Luther King. You'll find these two encampments, a small one, which is right adjacent to a much larger one. And they've been there for quite a while, the here, there, longer. And you'll see these signs, as I was trying to describe, large kind of just a 10-foot high placard letters here, there. I don't know, means like maybe homeless folks are here and there. Maybe they just decided to call it that. Anyway, musical break time. So check out these psychiatric songs, which are taken from an ancient record, put onto a reel-to-reel tape, put onto an audio cassette, and finally played through the medium of an ancient handheld recorder. Well, it's actually a little bit bigger than that, but it's still pretty ancient. But I liked it. The satire doesn't go as deep as I'd like, but it's clever in some respects. So check it out and enjoy it as a break from the what one might regard as the gloomy situation for folks outside generally, and maybe for the rest of us facing that alternative as the economy goes down. This first song is called Shrinker Man, and we join it in progress.
Can free me of my ticks and twitches, disconnect my latent switches, Shrinker Man. Shrinker Man, Shrinker Man, rise me up if you can, air my problem, bend, excuse me, simplify, and unconfuse me, Shrinker Man.
And that, I'm guessing, was most of Shrinker Man and The Will to Fail. Don't ask me who's singing it or who wrote it, but there it was. So tomorrow at 5 p.m., July 8th, if you're listening to this on the 7th, is deadline for any commentary to be sent to the Coastal Commission to oppose the Santa Cruz City Council's get the homeless out of town while pretending to be very liberal and compassionate and caring. Those who live in their vehicles, they'd be better off, I don't know, hiding in the bushes somewhere or fleeing from the police in other jurisdictions in their vehicles. And to do this, they have to make sure, the city authorities have to make sure that the Coastal Commission doesn't do what it did 5 or 6 years ago, actually longer than that, it was 2016, I guess it was 5 or 6 years ago, to declare that the coastal zone area is not something that can be essentially cut off from homeless folks without a serious consideration by the Coastal Commission. It's, that is to say, it was regarded as a substantive issue, which is the issue that will be determined at this Coastal Commission hearing on July 14th, which will be happening. You got to go online, look up Coastal Commission, look up its agenda, and at July 14th, under the Northern, I guess it's the Central California section, has the documents if you want to hear them. In fact, I'm going to be reading from one of those documents, which I've delayed too long reading. I wish I'd done this earlier, but I haven't, and there's very little time for people to put in their comments. And the issue is a kind of almost a technical one. How is this issue a substantial issue? The Coastal Commission did find it was a substantial issue. The issue of the appeal that the ACLU and the Santa Cruz CARES are now doing, and that I did way back in 2016 against what was then Rochelle Noroyan, councilwoman of the Times, nasty project to run the homeless out of town, or run their vehicles out of town, and is now, of course, been taken over by Martine Watkins and the whole crew that are with her. Watkins is currently the vice mayor, but she will soon be the mayor, if tradition is any guide. Of course, then there's Donna Myers, and of course, in the background, not in office at the moment, but struggling to fumigate the library with a parking structure all around it, Cynthia Matthews, in this new attempt to, well, for all you listeners who have been listening, you know what I'm talking about. For those who don't, I guess let's get back to the OVO. The technical issue for all you who are interested in the details of this Coastal Commission hearing coming up, and you can hear, you can watch it online. I think you can try to get in online, but I don't think they let anybody in. But a very brief presentation from both the city, which is defending itself, and the appellants, who have to share 3 minutes, which isn't very long. And I even think that may be at the discretion of the chair. Last time, ironically, when I was appealing this 5 or 6 years ago, there was a chair that was actually, he was the only vote who vote to uphold the city's position that this was not a substantial issue, so they could just rubber stamp the city's claims that it had adequate space for homeless people to go and visitors in their RVs, and there was adequate coastal access, all of which is bullshit. And the majority, the overwhelming majority, the Coastal Commission saw through it and refused to do it. And the city then backed off and said, oh, well, what that meant was they had to come back to a full hearing on the issue without the evidence. Well, so now they're doing this with the pretext that they have this safe parking program, which, of course, is a token program, doesn't really resolve the issue for all kinds of reasons. And some of them you're going to hear as I read the testimony that's being presented in one of the appeals from the Santa Cruz CARES group, which includes people like Alicia Kuhl and Joy Schindeldecker and Reggie Meisler, who kind of read this, led this, I should say. And you've also heard him on the show. I've been trying to reach him. He's a hard man to reach. I imagine he's pretty busy these days. And, well, I'll let some of these things speak for themselves. Before I do, though, again, the substantial issue determination supposedly has 5 prongs. The degree of factual and legal support for the local government's decision to cut off access. the extent, and this is number two, the extent and scope of the development approved by the local government, with the development in this case being exclusion of RVs completely from the coastal zone from midnight to 5 a.m., the significance of the coastal resources affected by the decision, that is the ability, it's actually the ability to be in the city at all in an RV if you are homeless, because you have to park. And you can't park anywhere in the city because this is citywide, even though the coastal zone only includes half the city. If the coastal zone accepts this, the city will be able to effectively start policing and threatening to tow the very homes of homeless and poor people who are aplenty in Santa Cruz still, in spite of the ongoing pogrom against them in vehicles and outside. If the Coastal Commission refuses and does what it did before and says it will uphold the appeal and deny the city, that means that the city cannot really afford to try to implement the ordinance, because if they do, everybody will flock to the coastal zone, part of the city, which they will not really credibly be able to enforce. Now, they have actually been enforcing coastal, inside the coastal zone, 72-hour laws that say you can't be in a particular spot for more than 72 hours. Even though they have not legally sought the consent or permits, even from their own local coastal people, to put up those signs. The signs are illegal, and that's been pointed out by numerous people in interviews that I've done through the years. It's even acknowledged by Ryan Maroney of the local Coastal Commission, who unfortunately is, I don't know, he's part of the same group. I don't know if he wrote the report, but the local Coastal Commission people are supporting the city's attempt to criminalize homeless people in these vehicles and saying, oh, it doesn't deny public access because it's only midnight to 5 p.m. That's not a time that's frequently used by decent people who have homes to go to or who can afford $120, $150 hotel rooms. You know, goodness gracious. Anyway, the fourth aspect of the prong is the precedential value of the local government's decision for future interpretations of its local coastal plan. This is all, of course, sounds very technical. But in other words, does making a decision of this kind have precedence? Well, apparently not as far as the city cares, because they didn't want to follow it even when the Coastal Commission said, don't go after people in the coastal zone unless you come back to us and show that this substantial issue of what the issue was A, you don't have storage for RVs, places for them to park in the area, really, and B, there's no crime problem that shows this is a really necessary thing. But that didn't deter city authorities and the Santa Cruz Police Department under Vogel, Mills, and now Escalante, I got his name actually, from doing the same kind of harassment of people for 72-hour parking in the coastal zone, supposedly violating the signs, or let's say leaving the signs up and claiming that's an authority. I mean, I suppose you could claim a state law that has nothing to do with the coastal zone, but you couldn't do it on the basis of those signs. No one has taken this to court, of course, which is a problem. But in any case, it's a precedent. If the coastal zone decides that it's okay for cities to criminalize homeless people in coastal zones at night, because that's going to drive them out. And that was recognized by the Coastal Commission back in 2016. And I'd kind of hoped it set a precedent. And indeed, there was a strengthening of an ordinance that gave the Coastal Commission the power to consider social justice issues more explicitly. But that isn't really mentioned much at all by the city, because I think they feel, and I think they do, have the local Coastal Commission in their pocket. And the local Coastal Commission finds on four of these 5 points, which I've told you four already, that the city's just fine. There's no need to go into there's no substantial issue here. Coastal Commission can just rubber stamp and move on. The fifth prong is whether the appeal raises only issues as opposed only local issues as opposed to those of regional or statewide significance. And obviously it has statewide significance because this is an issue, and this was brought up by members of the Coastal Commission the last time this came up. This comes up quite frequently, or let's put it this way, with some regularity. It has come up before. It will come up again. What should be the Coastal Commission's position as a general rule, not just as a local rule, but as a regional and state rule about criminalizing homeless people under the pretext that it doesn't really matter if you exclude them at night from coastal zones. Very nice for the tourist business, I guess, if you're a rich tourist or if you're a rich profiteer off of rich tourists or if you're a city seeking to tax and make a funding through that kind of tourism. Anyway, those are the three prongs of substantial issue determination that really the appeals people that are fighting this law, Reggie Meisler, the ACLU, the Disability Rights Coalition, and others, Santa Cruz Cares, need to address. And I'm going to read to you a lot of it, unfortunately, I don't know if they do address it, and I'll probably be talking to them on, if I do talk to them, I will be playing it on Sunday, the next showtime that I do this show at Sunday morning. But in the meantime, here's some of their appeal as they made it some weeks ago. Actually, I think it's almost 2 months ago now. So to begin with, here's Reggie Meisler's description of his appeal. The oversized vehicle ordinance is a parking permit program intended to restrict time, place, and manner in which a large vehicle may be parked on a public street in the city of Santa Cruz. Though it is seemingly framed in neutral tones in the ordinance's language, this is broadly understood to be an attempt to criminalize unhoused residents living in vehicles. During its development, the city attorney and then police chief Andy Mills said in plain language that the purpose of the OVO is to enhance the city's ability to prosecute folks living in vehicles for committing public nuisance-style offenses. A broad coalition of local homeless advocates have been very vocal about the failures of this ordinance and have their concerns ignored by the city council and city staff. Our first appeal to the Planning Commission resulted in some permit conditions which tried to find compromise. The City Council decided to call these conditions into review and removed all of them at that meeting while granting OVO its CDP, Coastal Development Permit. And the specifics that Reggie goes into, I think I may have mentioned, he actually goes into in some detail. And he also cites people who sign on, and that's who I'm going to read about rather than the technical details of why the OVO sucks, which I've kind of given you some indication of. And you can also go on to Santa Cruz Indie Media, and if you look into the archives there and look up Robert Norris or OVO, actually might not be under OVO because I don't think they called it that in 2016, but go back to 2016, looking up my name, and you'll find the presentations I made, which cover pretty much, they haven't changed that much. All they've done is created a token program that in no way serves even the homeless community in RVs and certainly doesn't deal with the whole RV situation because there are a lot of people who have RVs who aren't homeless, too, who are going to be denied the right to come, relatively poor people who come through Santa Cruz. Anyway, here are the quick breakdown of the co-appellants. People who are also appealing with Reggie Meisler are Chris Lang, a PhD student at UCSC who has struggled to find stable, affordable housing near campus, opting to live in his van in order to finish his education. Stacy Falls, local teacher for Santa Cruz City Schools, who has spent the last 3 years living in an RV after struggling to find affordable housing following an eviction from her rental home of 11 years. Micah Posner, a local homeless advocate who helped organize his neighborhood block to defend the right of unhoused people living in RVs and vans to park in their neighborhood without being intimidated, ticketed, or towed, and also had a miserable term on city council, I might add. Rachel Chavez, a local nurse and homeless advocate, well-versed in public health and social science research relating to public policy for the homeless. Alicia Kuhl, president of the Santa Cruz chapter of the California Homeless Union, spent several years living in an RV in the city and county of Santa Cruz with her partner and three children. Joy Schindeldecker, founder of a local mutual aid group known as Sanitation for the People, dedicated to helping reduce the presence of trash in and around homeless, houseless encampments, which is understood to often be the result of inadequate sanitation services provided by the city to the unhoused. Oh, they're shitting outside. Oh, they're leaving trash. You know, that sort of thing. Marisol Goulet is a local homeowner who owns an oversized vehicle, but is unable to stay in compliance with the OVO because her home does not have a driveway. Lyra Flippini, who has been involved in numerous local campaigns and activist causes and has personal experience working on the issue of homelessness in other communities. And I notice there aren't many of these people who are actually homeless at the moment, but let's hear some of what they have to say, or what is written that reflects their life situation. Well, here's what Stacy Falls wrote. She's, for me, a pretty familiar activist who's been fighting for a number of causes. No big buddy of mine particularly, but, you know, that's fine. I've spent the last 3 years living in an oversized vehicle, Stacy writes, and I'm opposed to the new oversized vehicle ordinance passed by the Santa Cruz City Council in 2019 when I was kicked out of my rental of 11 years in retaliation for campaigning for rent control. My life was turned upside down. Every day I pored over Craigslist hoping to find a reasonable rental, but day in and day out there was a dearth of listings in general, and all the listings were exorbitantly expensive, requiring half of my take-home pay. I don't believe living in Santa Cruz is a God-given right, but I have taught at Santa Cruz High School since 2006. I wanted to continue to live close to where I work, close to where I have built my life. Every day that I failed to find a rental, I worry that I would be forced to move, maybe out of the city, maybe out of the state altogether, moving away from friends and family because of a lack of affordable housing. Eventually, a friend offered to let me park an RV in his backyard. My husband and I bought a trailer and moved into my friend's backyard on Riverside, a half a mile from the ocean. This offer felt like a lifesaver, allowing me to stay in Santa Cruz close to my job, close to the beaches, close to the redwoods, close to my twin sister. We loved the community associated with being close to friends, and we were able to save enough money for a down payment on a house that we recently moved into. Santa Cruz is so painfully expensive. Average working people can simply not afford the rents, and buying a house is virtually impossible for most people. Even people who can afford rent sometimes have to fill out half a dozen rental applications with a rental search taking many months. Of course, people are moving into RVs and vans. There is no way for average people to live here without resorting to alternatives. Criminalizing people who are trying to be resourceful is cruel. Not only is it cruel, but driving average working people out of Santa Cruz means we will continue to have a shortage of baristas, wait staff, sanitation workers, and essential workers who are increasingly priced out. I urge you to overturn the city of Santa Cruz's oversized vehicle ordinance, Stacy Falls. Let's take a musical break.
Hear that guilty rag, I'm thrilled when I recall tell, afraid that time and life may mellow and mature you, afraid some clever analyst may in a decade cure you. Don't change your basic pattern, strange as so may be, away you are, my darling. You never can belong to anybody else but me. I love your streak of cruelty, your psychopathic lies, the homicidal tendencies shining in your eyes. Don't change your psychic structure, weird as it may be. Your endless fantasies, your morbid little tears. You make me feel so needed, sweet, with your countless fears. Don't change your old neuroses. They're what make you mine, for no one else, dear,
and that was The Guilty Rag and Stay As Sick As You Are, or that's what I would pick up from the lyrics anyway. And now back to the appeal to the Coastal Commission by Santa Cruz Cares, Reggie Meisler and the folks joining with him to try to maintain some basic, I don't want to call it sanity, because forcing people to live in RVs is not sane at all, but jumping them from RVs out onto the ground or forcing them out of town is even more insane. So it's a matter of real insanity, or let's put it this way, lesser of two insanities, something like that. Here's a letter from Micah Posner, who also signed this appeal. I was on the city council from 2012 to 2016 when the council, or the city, tried to pass a similar ordinance banning parking without allowing enough designated spaces to meet the demand for the parking by residents, and certainly not for visitors. I voted against the ordinance, and it was later overruled by the commission, but my more pertinent experience with rules designed to stop people from sleeping in RVs comes from my experience in neighborhood Lower Ocean, which is a diverse neighborhood near the ocean in the city of Santa Cruz, bonded by the San Lorenzo River, San Lorenzo Park, and the hill going east up to Seabright. Our neighborhood recently discussed the issue of people living in RVs in a somewhat formal matter. I'm going to tell you about it as it seems relevant to your current decision. For several years now, ever since a hotel closed on Riverside Avenue near Barson Street, there has been an official safe sleeping zone, or unofficial safe sleeping zone, for RV dwellers, two to six of them at any given time. In early 2020, unbeknownst to all of us, or most of us, one of our neighbors asked Public Works to run off the RV dwellers by painting parking spaces on the street that would preclude them parking there. When we heard about the effort, a group of us went door to door and talked to our immediate neighbors about the effort. About our support for people living in RVs who have no other place to go. Below is the first batch of petitions we turned in. I don't remember how many signatures we got in the end. 50 to 100, I think. Brian Borguno from Public Works probably still has them. What he doesn't mention, of course, in this is that the police department led this campaign, or at least was involved in the campaign, going door to door soliciting, let's get these RVs out
by narrowing the parking spaces. Activity as the police department has done in other areas, as with Joe Habe at Almar on Almar Avenue. And he's still up to his old tricks, as far as that's the latest report you may remember if you've listened to this show recently, from Alicia Cool. Anyway, in the end, Micah Posner continues, we turned in significantly more signatures in favor of allowing the RVs to park than the people who were against it, even though the police, the neighborhood enforcement team, he did mention it, helped gather signatures against them. In the process, we did hear some complaints about the RV dwellers, mostly about trash being left on the sidewalk. We met with the RV dwellers and asked them to take care of their trash and make sure their dogs were supervised. I've noticed that there is a lot less trash, although there was at least one pile that was left for a long time. And Katie, who rents a few houses from me, borrowed my wheelbarrow and picked it up. I think that all of us involved feel proud to be hosting the people in the RVs, and we feel empowered to talk to them when there are problems. In summation, we had a good dialogue as a small neighborhood, just a few blocks, really, and came to the conclusion that we wanted to support people living in RVs and communicate our concerns to them. Not everyone was happy, but most people felt okay about the result. I feel certain that my immediate neighbors do not support this proposed ordinance, and I am certain that our little neighborhood has given it more thought than most places. Based on my recent experience, I feel confident that a whole lot of people wouldn't support this ordinance if they were asked, but they are not as likely to contact their public agencies as the people who are upset, feel powerful, and, quote, want something done. Personally, my idea about neighbors is that you try to work with them when there are problems. You don't try to run them off. For example, when someone seems to be sleeping in a vehicle in front of my house, of whatever size, I try to introduce myself and get to know them a little bit. My family and I have never had a problem with these folks. I'm wondering how many of the people supporting the RV criminalization ordinance have tried to talk to the people living in the RVs about their concerns prior to trying to run them out of town via an ordinance. I've also met nice folks, mostly older people who are living in RVs while traveling around the country for a few months or a year at the Simpkins Swim Center, among other places. They kind of remind me of John Steinbeck in Travels with Charlie, where he specifically praises the open hospitality of the people of northern coastal California for allowing him to visit in his RV. Hospitality is not something we can turn on and off based on a visitor's income level. We either have it or we don't. I would like to have it. I know that America and California is kind of fraying at the edges, and it is a bummer to see people living in a way that is kind of desperate and not pretty. I understand why people want to push that spectacle away from their homes. My wife and I try to teach our children to deal with the truth as it is and to be as kind as you can without putting oneself at risk. I don't think this is the spirit of the proposed ordinance, and based on my recent experience, I don't think my neighbors support it either, which makes me kind of proud, to be honest. Thanks for hearing my neighborhood story, Micah Posner. And here is Rachel Chavez writing her story. I am writing today out of immense concern about a harmful policy that will fall under your jurisdiction, the oversized vehicle ordinance. At a Coastal Commission hearing in 2016, several commissioners expressed concern about the law, calling it onerous, drastic, and draconian. The ordinance has not meaningfully changed since then. The new permitting process requires one to have a city address, which many who have lost homes in Santa Cruz, such as those displaced by the CZU fire, no longer have. If someone is able to get a hold of a permit, they still would only be able to sleep in their vehicle home for a maximum of 12 days out of the month. This permit system essentially bans poor people who live in their RVs from existing in Santa Cruz, thus targeting low-income people and restricting their access to the Santa Cruz coast. By the city's own estimate, there are around 300 oversized vehicles used as homes, and currently 15 safe parking sites in the city. As written in the ordinance, the city has to provide only 3 additional safe parking spaces in order for this law to go into effect, and then 30 additional spots within 4 months of that date. The numbers do not add up. Importantly, the city does have the power and the resources to mitigate many of the neighborhood complaints about oversized vehicles without segregating access to our coastline based on income and housing status. Simply increasing access to sanitation resources where RVs are currently located would create better living standards for those living in RVs, the surrounding communities, and our environment, all while maintaining equitable access to our beautiful coast.
The results of ordinances that target poor people living in their vehicles is well documented. They directly contribute to an increase in unsheltered homelessness, disability, and premature death. We've already seen this locally as a result of SCPD's Operation West Side, which pushed multiple individuals and families into unsheltered homelessness. We have decades of research confirming that criminalizing homelessness is expensive, ineffective, and traumatizing. Yet our city government continues to parrot harmful myths that enable bad policy. The veracity of the data supporting this is so substantial that even entities like the U.S. Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, the United Nations Human Rights Council, the American Medical Association, and the American Public Health Association unequivocally condemn policies that criminalize homelessness as OVO does. Quality of life ordinances like OVO and CSSO, that's community, the Camping Standards and Services Ordinance, the new sleeping ban, have dire consequences that are compounded along the lines of race, gender, disability, and sexual identity, perpetuating health inequalities. According to one researcher, when anti-homeless laws are enacted, quote, homeless individuals have continual interactions with law enforcement that are designed to punish, even if they don't lead to arrest. This creates a never-ending cycle of homelessness, inflicting material and psychological harm, while deepening racial, gender, and health inequalities among the urban poor. Although public health is often invoked when criminalization policies are marketed to the public, these types of laws are well known to worsen public health by dispersing people and their belongings to remote areas with nowhere to discard trash or bodily waste, not to mention the drastic negative effects on the health of the people being displaced. City council members and city officials have argued that OVO does not criminalize because it prioritizes civil penalties over criminal ones. It helps to enforce laws that are already on the books, and because there is a clause that supposedly will be used to let people avoid tickets if they register to accept safe parking sites, even if none are available. This ignores the fact that vehicular living is already criminalized at a baseline in California. This ignores the fact that OVO intentionally makes enforcement a priority for police to target those living in oversized vehicles. This ignores that giving parking tickets to people who cannot afford to pay them leads to fines, misdemeanors, inability to register vehicles, and ultimately towing of shelter. This ignores the significant gas expenditures people will need to be able to afford in order to get to and from safe parking locations day after day. This ignores the fact that the former chief of police Andy Mills and city attorney Tony Condotti admitted in plain language at city council meetings that this ordinance was designed to create a more efficient way for the city to be able to prosecute people living in their vehicles because, as Condotti said, quote, even if you write a ticket, even if you write a misdemeanor, the way the court process works these days, they would be right back on the street within an hour engaging in the same behaviors as before. So moving these vehicles along seems to be the only way to address these issues. Or as Mills said, OVO, quote, will give us the opportunity to cite with misdemeanors and then have our own city attorney prosecute. The courts are so overwhelmed with other cases, these cases that can't be prosecuted, and the city attorney has a better track record of getting these things prosecuted. We've written hundreds of tickets. It can help for a while, but it comes right back. This ignores the fact that there is an ever-growing body of research describing the phenomenon and impact of pervasive penalty, where, quote, consistent punitive interactions with state officials rarely result in arrest, but do cause material and psychological harm, reproducing homelessness and deepening racial, gender, and health inequalities. This ignores studies that show that when quality of life ordinances are enacted, their ostensible goals of expanding services are frequently not met, instead seeing an increase in fines, citations, and arrests. And all of these claims are footnoted if you want to check out the Santa Cruz CARES appeal, which is available if you go to the Coastal Commission's documents for the July 14th hearing that's coming up. Lastly, Rachel Chavez continues, this ignores that the city council, based on recommendations from city staff, removed a provision by the planning department, among other evidence-based measures for safe parking, that would have required the city to have a plan for providing police with real-time availability of safe parking spaces in order for them to be able to enforce the ordinance. It is clear to me that the spirit in which this ordinance was created, confirmed by the city attorney at a September 21, 2021 city council meeting, was one of desire to harass our vehicularly housed neighbors in the hopes that they wind up either leaving town or in jail. Research heavily suggests that the former is unlikely, while the latter is practically guaranteed. Services without the threat of criminalization is not only possible, moral, and just, it is also the most data-informed, evidence-based, and effective policy prescription for mitigating the harms of homelessness. Please reject the oversized vehicle ordinance from receiving a coastal design permit. Thank you for your time. Rachel Chavez, registered nurse, Lower Ocean neighbor. And, of course, the problem with all these really articulate critiques of the OVO is they don't really go to the substantial issue determination, which is almost a technical matter. And I'm hoping that the Reggie and those who are working with this, and maybe I'll be able to interview him sometime before the deadline, Friday, which is tomorrow for me, July 8th, but at least before July 14th, so people can be aware of this. And remember, the struggle doesn't end. Even if the Coastal Commission turns down the city and supports the appeal and says this is a substantial issue, because it did so 5 years ago and the city continued to harass RVs. This is going to require neighborhood, community, and activist action to essentially hold police and NIMBYs and the city council and the city manager accountable for this stuff. Financially accountable, and maybe even criminally accountable if it reaches that stage, which in fact it already has. When you steal someone's home, when you put them out on the street, when you cause their health to deteriorate, that's, if it isn't already, it should be a crime. I can't say exactly what law it violates, but let's hope it violates some law. Let's take another musical break.
Go to sleep, my little one. You're passing through a stage. Not at all uncommon at your age. These are traumatic days in oh so many ways. Each new taboo comes to you as a shock. But rest secure in your little crib. Oh, rest secure. Forget each little block. Cause daddy is reading Freud and Duvel. While mommy reads Adler and Spock. Hush, little sibling, don't you cry. You'll be adjusted by and by. I recognize that fretful look. Mommy's gonna try another book. Ooh. Hush, little sibling, don't you cry.
Hush, little sibling, don't you cry.
That's going to be about it for this edition of Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. I'm going to be picking up on more stories from this Coastal Commission appeal because I think it really covers a lot of field and it answers a lot of the concerns that, let's say, people might have who are wondering why the OVO isn't such a great idea, because after all, it does provide some safe parking spaces. And there are some problems with some people who park in their vehicles, and this is a good way to deal with it. I think there's a lot of both humans directly addressing other humans here, and as well as statistics and findings, as they say, evidence that there is a real bad decision being made when you go after criminalizing poor people. I'm actually, even if it were a socially effective decision, I tend to be of the opinion you don't want to do it anyway, because it removes basic human rights, which, however efficient, as we found in Germany during World War II, there are ways to mobilize the population that could be effective for some of them, but very devastating for others, and that's not what we want. At least that's not what I want. So I'll be back at you again on Sunday, likely. And if you want to comment on this show, give me a call at, as I mentioned before, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. If you want to get into the, the appeal process, I don't think... It's pretty late. There's only, as I said, one day before the deadline. But if you're interested, you might want to go online to the California Coastal Commission's website, and you can still make comments, I believe. I've been delaying doing it myself, but I will probably be churning something out at the last minute. It's really difficult, as I said, because once you win, you have to keep winning because the authorities often don't pay attention to what other authorities say if they think they can get away with it, and they will get away with it unless we are challenging them. So, that's it. Thanks for listening. Back at you again next time.
Along the way, we'll bring to you new color, new dimensions, new values.